to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Since 2004, Project Censored's annual yearbook has included a chapter highlighting the efforts of activists, teachers, journalists, and media producers whose work is defined by media activism, education, and analysis in the service of democracy and freedom of expression. Today, on the Project Censored Show, Media Democracy in Action. We'll talk about all of this year's contributors, people that are making a difference for our free press. We'll talk to Professor Steve Masick for the hour he helped compile the chapter this year. Stay with us.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program and in this segment, we are going to talk about media democracy in action. Well, for more than four decades, as our guest Steve Masick writes, Project Censored has been documenting how the news that the public receives is shaped, filtered, and slanted by government agencies, the military, affluent media owners, advertisers, Republican and Democratic politicians, business-funded think tanks, lobbyists, PR, flacks, and other elite interests. Every year, the annual censored volume enumerates important stories that were either completely ignored by the establishment press or given only minimal cursory coverage. And of course, each year at Project Censored, we not only cover the news that doesn't make the news and analyze why and talk about junk food news and news abuse propaganda, we also highlight organizations and individuals that are doing stellar free press and First Amendment work. That's what we do in Media Democracy in Action every year. And today on the show, we have Dr. Steve Masick. He helped compile and edit that chapter of the book for Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass. Steve Masick is professor of communications and chair of the Department of Communication and Media Studies at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, outside of Chicago. Steve Masick is also the author of Urban Nightmares, The Media, The Right, and The Moral Panic Over the City, and his op-eds and essays about the media, politics, and free speech issues have been published in a wide range of magazines and newspapers, including Z Magazine, St. Louis Journalism Review, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Columbus Dispatch, News and Observer. He's also a longtime member of the Union for Democratic Communications and, of course, a stalwart ally of us here at Project Censored. Steve Masick, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, Mickey, it's great to be on the show.
And I know we have a lot to talk about because you've been working with us on the top censored stories for next year's book.
Which has been a real pleasure, and I'm a huge supporter of, you know, everything Project Censored does. And it was a real pleasure to work on this chapter on media democracy in action for a second year. We have featured in the chapter a quite amazing group of media activists and activist groups working on transparency in government initiatives, journalists' rights, and First Amendment rights. So this year, the chapter profiles the work of the Society of Professional Journalists. There's a piece by Catherine Foxhall of Society for Professional Journalists about censorship by public information officers that I'd like to talk to you a little bit about. We showcased Russ Kick, who I'm sure your readers are very familiar with, who is, I think, the author of and editor of the Disinfopedia, who has been a real advocate of transparency in government. And his contribution to the chapter looks at the attempts by government agencies to destroy key government documents without very much public input or transparency, and his role in bringing more transparency to that process. A really interesting report written by Matthew Crane and Tony Nadler for Data and Society about the digital influence machine, which I think is really interesting. We profiled DSmog Blog, which is a blog that works to debunk climate deniers and their propaganda. We profiled a rank-and-file labor organization That's also a rank and file labor journalism effort called Labor Note. And then finally, we profiled the work of the website that's been around for a very long time called Propaganda Critic, and recently was revamped and retooled for the new digital age. And it's a really great resource for those of us who teach critical media literacy. So there's a lot to talk about in this chapter, and I'm happy to start wherever you'd like.
And so, Steve, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule teaching, and we're all transitioning in this strange time of coronavirus in education. We've had a lot of different and new challenges. But of course, at the core of many of the challenges we face societally, we have media democracy challenges. And that's why it's so important that we're not just calling out in the book, oh, how the corporate media didn't do this or how they framed that. We're also highlighting, as you do here, what is working well for the free press and what are some really stalwart people on the front lines fighting for media democracy and free press principles. So, Steve, you mentioned censorship through public information officers, and Catherine Foxhall, Society of Professional Journalists, she did a great job here. Maybe you can summarize this story for our listeners, and specifically why it matters. And
I became aware of the work that the Society of Professional Journalists was doing on this when I heard Catherine Foxhall give a presentation on this topic at an American Association of University Professors conference a couple of years ago. And the Society of Professional Journalists has been conducting surveys of journalists about their access to government information for years. And what they've been finding is that increasingly reporters are not able to directly access frontline workers, for example, in the CDC, in the FDA, in the EPA, and other government agencies, because every time they want to do an interview, say, with a researcher who's working on a virus or a cure for a virus, or a researcher who's working on some aspect of environmental policy, they're directed to direct their questions to the public information officer. And in some cases, journalists who, for example, want to interview police officers or other people involved in law enforcement are told that they can't do those interviews with individual officers or individual prison officials or what have you, unless a public information officer is present. And this represents a real shift, as she points out in her contribution, from the way things used to work. It used to be that, for example, in Washington, D.C., journalists could roam the halls of various government agencies and interview the people who are actually working on important issues. And that used to be a great source of information for them about things that were really happening. But increasingly, they have to pose their questions to basically PR hacks, to people who are employed to give evasive answers and to cover things up, not to share honest information with people. And so she calls this censorship by public information officer, because essentially, journalists are being blocked from speaking to the staff of organizations directly and are being given pre-vetted, pre-screened PR answers by these professional spin docs. They're curating the message and honing the message. It's not what we normally think of as censorship. We normally think of as censorship as the government cracking down on and preventing communication from happening. But this is a serious problem with regard to the public's access to important information, because it's all being filtered through these gatekeepers who are very careful not to share information that might in any way damage, say, the reputation of the Trump administration. It's censorship by other means, especially given that there are very strict parameters being placed on the kinds of interviews that journalists can do with various government officials. And this is coming from on high, and speaking with her that she has theories about why this is happening. It's almost like all of the government agencies are permanently in campaign mode and they're treating every interaction with the press as if it's part of a political campaign. And that is really hurting the public's access to really important information about, as she points out in the article, about things like food safety, environmental safety, law enforcement, et cetera. So I think it's a really sensational contribution, and you know, the work that the Society of Professional Journalists has been doing on this has been really important.
It certainly is, and Catherine Foxhall gives several examples here, actually quite chilling ones for our listeners. One was that she writes, most chilling perhaps were the survey results from police reporters, 56% of whom said they rarely or never get to interview police officers without the involvement of public information officers. So as you were just saying, Steve Masick, intermediaries, yeah. PR flacks.
And she also makes the point that this is exactly this kind of, so, you know, I don't think she included in here, but in conversations with her, she's made the point to me that this is exactly the kind of thing that has led to debacles like what happened at the University of Maryland, where there was a cover-up that occurred over a University of Maryland football player who died at practice. And, you know, the Sports Information Office was not allowing reporters to talk directly to members of the team or to members of the staff. They were filtering the kind of information that people were getting. And it just led to this big cover-up that then resulted in, I think, the whole staff of the football team ultimately being fired when the real facts emerged. That kind of mediation of the access of reporters to officials or to employees of any kind of organization just lends itself to abuse.
And again, she points out kids drinking lead in water, gymnasts being right. abused for decades, the fentanyl epidemic brewing for years. Foxhall writes, these were all hidden stories until they were practically dropped on reporters' heads, she writes. So this is a really pernicious kind of censorship, and it's harder to detect for the general public.
It is much harder to detect, right. And what she suggests is back in the day when reporters could roam freely and talk to whomever they wanted, they were more likely to pick up on those kinds of stories, for example, like lead in the water or gymnasts being abused, because they'd be talking to people all throughout an organization on a routine basis, and those kinds of stories would be shared with them earlier. They'd realize that something was wrong and they'd start digging. It makes it very difficult for journalists to even figure out what's going on when people won't talk to them. And the only people they can talk to are people who are professional communicators skilled at spinning.
I just wanted to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're talking right now with Professor Steve Masick. He's in the Department of Communications and Media Studies at North Central College outside of Chicago. Steve Masick, a longtime associate with us at Project Censored and Union for Democratic Communications. Steve compiled our Media Democracy in Action chapter this last year for Censored 2020. And after this musical break, we're going to come back and talk to Steve Masick about Russ Kick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Professor Steve Masick. He edited the Media Democracy in Action chapter for Censored 2020. Steve is author of a number of books and numerous academic articles. He's also someone that's been on the front lines with us at Project Censored, helping us with validated independent news stories, censored news stories. Several of Steve's students every year have contributions in our books. And this year, Steve contributed once again to our Media Democracy in Action chapter, compiling some great organizations and people that are doing stellar and important First Amendment work. We just got done talking about Society of Professional Journalists and Catherine Foxhall on public information officers. And right now, Steve Masick, you wanted to talk about Russ Kick. And Russ Kick, of course, is also a fellow author at Seven Stories with us, the Disinformation series, the anthology of the graphic canon. Tell our listeners, Steve Masick, tell our listeners a little bit about why Russ Kick, a writer, an anthropologist, a transparency activist, why is Russ Kick so important and what did he write for us this year in the book?
Russ Kick is a longtime transparency activist and Freedom of Information Act advocate, and he has been an investigative journalist and a writer. He's published a number of different books, including this, as you mentioned, best-selling graphic canon series where classic works of literature are turned into graphic novels. He runs a website called AltGov2, which is dedicated to government transparency. And the contribution he made to the chapter this year is entitled Pressuring the National Archives to Be More Transparent About the Destruction of Government Documents. In that chapter, he throws a spotlight on the fact that the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, has routinely destroyed a huge volume of government documents that we as a public may need to have access to so that we can figure out what our government has been doing. Historians might need to have access to it in order to be able to reconstruct accurately various aspects of American history. And the NARA is charged with retaining documents that might be important in any way and then making decisions about those documents that are expendable and can be destroyed. Apparently, every year, only about 1-3% of all federal government documents are designated as permanent, meaning that they can never be destroyed. Those are often things that are generated by the courts or, you know, by Congress. But something like 97% of all the documents generated by the federal government are eventually either shredded or wiped off of hard drives or otherwise destroyed.
Only 1-3% of federal documents are designated as permanent, meaning that they can't be destroyed. And then you said the other 97-99% are eventually shredded, wiped out, or destroyed.
Shredded, they're wiped from hard drives, or they're otherwise destroyed. And the time frame for keeping documents varies. Some documents can be destroyed immediately. Others have to be kept for a certain amount of time. Some of the documents that are routinely destroyed are things like pay records of various kinds, routine week-to-week pay records and things like that. But there are certain documents that are designated to be permanently preserved. And there's two ways that the documents get scheduled for destruction. One is that NARA issues some sort of government-wide records retention schedules for particular types of documents. For example, for things like minutes of meetings, which say you have to keep these certain sorts of documents or these kinds of documents can be destroyed. But the other way that they do it is by creating a proposal called a request, by having an agency create a proposal called a request to NARA where they specify which documents they would like to destroy and why. And then NARA then has to open that up for public comment, and they publish a notice about proposals, aka requests, that they've received from agencies about destroying documents. They publish those in the Federal Register, and then there's a period of public comment where people can weigh in within 30 days, or at least this is what it used to be, within 30 days, on whether or not NARA should honor that agency's request. Well, what he discovered, so he started paying very close attention to this, as he says in the piece, in 2017, and what he discovered was something really shocking. He noticed that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, wanted to destroy all documents about the deaths and rapes of people detained in its facilities after a retention period of 20 years, and that NARA had given preliminary approval to this really awful request. He then posted the proposal and NARA's preliminary approval of the proposal on his website, and he notified a bunch of reporters, and then, of course, the ACLU found out about it, and they picked up the story, and it went viral, and then all of a sudden, NARA subsequently announced that it would be requiring ICE to make unspecified changes to its proposals because it seemed so outrageous that they would destroy documents that were evidence of deaths and rapes in ICE facilities after just 20 years. Then he started paying really, really close attention to it, and he discovered that the National Security Agency, NSA, this is in 2018, had proposed to destroy all complaints and inquiries it received about civil liberties after a retention period of only 1 year. And he started then receiving every single document destruction proposal that NRA received. And he discovered that the Department of Interior, and this is one that made actual news after he started talking about it, he discovered that the Department of Interior, which is in charge of the national parks, had made a huge omnibus proposal to the NRA proposing to destroy a huge mass of documents about oil and gas leases on public lands, mining, dams, wells, timber sales, fishing, and endangered species, about critical habitats, about land acquisitions, and a whole lot more. So they wanted to destroy all of these documents, sensitive documents relating to, for example, sale of mineral rights on public property to private corporations. He noticed right away that this was fishy. He set up a separate web page informing reporters about it, and there was a massive amount of attention. Environmentalists, scientists, animal rights activists started speaking out about it. NARA was flooded with public comments about this proposal to destroy these documents. They received something like 12,000 comments, thousands more than the agency normally receives on the proposals. And so kind of as a result of all of this critical attention that Kick and his website had shined on the document destruction process as NARA was running it, NARA made some significant changes to the way they handle this. They said they'd be immediately posting online all schedules for record document proposals. They would create an online system that would allow public comment on the proposals, and they extended the comment period from 30 to 45 days. And NARA themselves credited this sea change to, quote, clear, widespread interest from the public in the previously obscure document destruction process. And that's all really a credit to the work that Kick did. As he points out in his piece, there's a lot more that needs to be done. And part of this is that back when the documents that the federal government generated were all printed on paper and held in file cabinets in the basement at huge government-owned warehouses, maybe it made sense to periodically go through and destroy all that paper, because there's just a physical limit to how many documents the federal government can retain. It costs money to do that. But now, since most of the documents that the federal government generates are digital and really take up very little space at all and cost a fraction of what they used to cost to store and retain, it raises this question, maybe destroying 97 to 99% of all federal government documents doesn't make sense anymore. And he also makes the point that there are a lot more people who need to be involved in the discussions and the decisions about what is slated for destruction among our government documents, what gets sent down the memory hole. As he points out, historians should be involved, they have a vested interest in being able to access this, and transparency organizations need to have a seat at the table. Civil liberties organizations need to have a seat at the table. And so he makes the point that even though things have changed a little bit, there's still room for change, and he outlines some specific proposals that he'd like to see followed. I think it's a really fantastic chapter that sort of shines a light on a problem that most of us were completely unaware of. Even those of us who follow the news carefully were not aware until Russ Kitt started investigating.
Russ has the Memory Hole blog and certainly has been riffing on that for quite some time, the Orwellian nature of our society. And of course, the U.S. National Archives, not too long ago, was in hot water about censoring images from the Women's March. Another story of censorship. They actually got called out on it, and they said, oh yeah, that's not a good idea. But the stuff that Russ Kitt is unearthing is stuff that most of us would never hear about.
Exactly. We wouldn't if it weren't for his activism, the fact that he posted this information on his website and then alerted journalists who then reported on it. We wouldn't have known about this stuff.
So this is exactly the kind of thing that we cover in the Media Democracy in Action chapter every year. Russ Kitt also did the memoryhole2.org. So again, all the folks we're talking about have done amazing work. Catherine Foxhall, we just spoke about, Society of Professional Journalists, now just Russ Kitt. Certainly can learn more about him. I want to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking right now with Steve Masick. He is professor of communications and chair of the Department of Communication and Media Studies at North Central College outside of Chicago. He is author of Urban Nightmare, The Media, the Right, and the Moral Panic Over the City. He has contributed to many papers and conferences and journals. He also is a longtime contributor to Project Censored, both with our top censored stories with his students. And also this past year, second year in a row, Steve Masick did our Media Democracy in Action chapter. And after this musical break, we're going to return with Steve Masick, and we're going to highlight even more individuals and organizations that are doing stellar free press work. And if you don't know about them, you should, and you will. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to bring to you Professor Steve Masick. He's chair of the Department of Communications and Media Studies at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. He's author of Urban Nightmares, The Media, the Right, and the Moral Panic Over the City. He is a media scholar involved in Union for Democratic Communications. He's worked with us at Project Censored for a number of years. And today, Steve Masick joins us to talk about the edited and compiled chapter that he put together for Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass. It's our Media Democracy in Action chapter. Every year, we look at what groups or individuals are doing stellar free press and First Amendment work. And Steve Masick joins us today by phone. Steve!
Thanks again for having me on to talk about the work of these excellent organizations profiled in the chapter on Media Democracy in Action. The next group I'd like to talk about is sort of a hybrid of a magazine and a kind of an organizing initiative called Labor Notes. It's both a magazine and an umbrella organization for rank and file labor activists. And it is really, I think, the premier labor media outlet in the United States today. one of the huge problems with the corporate media is they have a real blind spot when it comes to reporting on labor unions and labor issues. As my friend Christopher Martin has pointed out in his incisive new book, No Longer Newsworthy, How Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, most big commercial news organizations in the U.S. today no longer have even a single labor or workplace reporter on staff. And they increasingly, corporate news organizations cater their content to very affluent, upscale audience. That's why it seems profitable to them to have a whole section of the paper devoted to reviews of higher-end gourmet restaurants, but not to have even a single column devoted to what's happening with labor unions in the areas that they supposedly serve and report on. And that's why, and I think labor activists have always known that you couldn't really trust the corporate media to be a voice for working people. So there has been a long history in the U.S. of workers and labor organizations creating their own media, their own newspapers. Here where I am in Chicago, there used to be a number of different labor-oriented and labor newspapers. And Labor Notes is really the premier outlet for labor news in the U.S. today. In fact, right now, as you know, we're living through this COVID-19 crisis. What the corporate media isn't reporting about this is that it's also leading to a number of wildcat strikes as workers at Amazon and other kinds of workplaces are protesting about the lack of personal protective equipment or other kinds of abuse from employers. And the corporate media isn't really reporting on that. But one outlet that is reporting on that story is Labor Notes. And it was founded in 1979, really to bring together what were called rank and file movements for greater democracy in labor unions, like the activists inside the Teamsters Union called Teamsters for a Democratic Union, together so that they could talk and share common concerns. And they realized they needed a media outlet or a media organ of their own. And so they established Labor Notes. And they've been at this for about 40 years. They like to call themselves the troublemaking wing of the labor movement. And it's the only place where you can turn in the media to learn stories about like this. And I'm just going to read here about one of the stories that they published. Quote, a hospital x-ray tech in Buffalo explained in a piece that he published for Labor Notes how he and his coworkers shamed their employer out of cutting one worker's pay by organizing a tongue-in-cheek fundraising drive featuring jars of pennies. Another story was about how two Macy's department store workers in Seattle co-authored an account of the creative contract tactics that they employed to get hundreds of new members involved in their unions. A shop steward at a West Virginia grocery store wrote a story about how she had led an impromptu march on the boss that cowed a manager into tearing up an unfair disciplinary measure on the spot. Those are some of the sorts of stories they reported on. They were one of the go-to sources of information for people who are following and interested in the whole series of wildcat teacher strikes that broke out across Arizona, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and Kentucky. It was pretty newsworthy material. And it's not as if, I will say, to be fair, and it wasn't as if the corporate media didn't cover it, but they certainly didn't cover it the way Labor Notes did, mm-hmm. because Labor Notes was actually talking to and had long been in touch with and communicating with the people actually organizing and leading these efforts. And so they were showcasing the voices of workers as part of the coverage of those stories in a way that the corporate media rarely does. And the corporate media was completely taken by surprise by that outbreak of wildcat strikes, whereas a publication like Labor Notes knew it was coming because they have been covering this sort of thing for a long time, and they have their ear to the ground, and they have contacts in workplaces all over the country. So this contribution from Alexa Bradley, the editor of Labor Notes, was a really great addition. And it's another side to the Media Democracy in Action chapter, which is showcasing the excellent work of independent media outlets who report on stories that are not getting enough attention from the corporate press.
Indeed. And Steve Masick, you brought up earlier that the corporate papers, the corporate media, even NPR and PBS, which we increasingly include in that category because of the funding and so-called underwriting, they always start the financial news, the stock market, the business community, Wall Street, and it's all top down. There's a business section. There's not a labor section. So there needs to be outlets like Labor Notes or, you know, Steve Zeltzer's Workweek radio program, Labor Fest out here in California every summer, a massive multi-week conference on labor. Right out of Chicago, again, Steve, right where you are, in these times. The great work of Sarah Lazare, that's a great labor publication. So these things exist, but they seem to fall well outside the attention of corporate media or so-called mainstream media. You don't see CNN running too many clips on labor issues. And when they do cover things, they cover them as labor disputes or strikes or problems. It's never a management dispute.
And people who've analyzed labor stories have made this point that if you look at the way the corporate media covers labor issues and things like strikes or other labor actions, they always say that management makes offers at the bargaining table where labor makes demands rather than vice versa, that labor made an offer, labor unions made an offer, and the management was making demands. So just the very loaded language that is used to describe what's taking place, for example, when people are negotiating over a contract, tells you right away where the sympathies of the corporate press lie. And of course, that's not really surprising because at most of these corporate media outlets, management and the owners have done everything they can to keep labor unions out and to break the unions that do exist. And so this is one of the reasons why Chomsky and Herman's propaganda model is so compelling to me as an explanation for why the news media behave the way they do, why they cover the stories that they do, and why they cover them the way that they cover them. Because one of the things they suggest, Chomsky and Herman suggest in their propaganda model, is that an important, significant filter on the kind of news that the public receives is the ownership. The ownership of media is, according to Chomsky and Herman, one of the significant forces shaping the kind of news that the public receives. And you might think, and there is this myth, that the media is liberal because a lot of reporters are personally liberals. They might vote Democratic. They might contribute money to Planned Parenthood or to the Sierra Club. But the fact of the matter is the owners of the media are people like Rupert Murdoch. They are multimillionaires, and they have a real record of being adamantly anti-labor and anti-labor rights, and strongly in favor of deregulation, of lower taxes for businesses, and really hostile to especially labor unions and the right to organize. A good example of this is Comcast, which is one of the five or six largest media conglomerates in the country. Comcast has this track record of being an incredibly anti-labor corporation. Every time they take over or acquire a new media property, when they, for example, took over AT&T's cable properties, the first thing they tried to do was to smash and to break the union. They were also one of the biggest contributors to lobbying efforts against the one piece of pro-labor legislation that the Obama administration very weakly backed, but it was being considered early on in Obama's presidency, which is the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have basically made it easier for workers to organize unions. If workers or employees at a particular workplace were able to gather a certain number of signatures on certification cards, they would be automatically recognized as a collective bargaining agent rather than having to go through an election. And this was something that the populists like Bernie Sanders in Congress were pushing. Comcast spent millions of dollars lobbying against it. So as a corporation, as a business, they have a track record, and their corporate executives have a track record of being very hostile to labor unions. So why would you think that NBC, which is owned now by Comcast, would be fair to labor in their news coverage? It just doesn't make sense. The corporate parent company is run by people who are adamantly opposed to labor unions, actively hostile to pro-labor legislation. Why would you expect them to cover this fairly? And as a result, if you want to have an accurate or even-handed picture of what's going on with labor rights, you have to turn to outlets like Labor Notes.
We're talking with communications scholar Steve Masick. He's chair of the Department of Communication and Media Studies at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, outside of Chicago. Steve Masick compiled the Media Democracy in Action chapter for Censored 2020. And after this musical break, in our last segment, Steve Masick and I will talk a little bit more about what's in that chapter. We'll talk about the propaganda critic and a few other things, and we'll also talk about the state of the free press today. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been delighted to bring to you our special guest, Dr. Steve Masick. He is chair of the Department of Communication and Media Studies at North Central College outside of Chicago. He's author of Urban Nightmares, The Media, The Right, and the Moral Panic Over the City. He has published many articles in a variety of newspapers, political magazines, academic journals. He's also a member of the Union for Democratic Communications and longtime contributor to Project Censored. This is the second year in a row that Steve Masick has compiled one of our more exciting chapters, I think, every year. It's the Media Democracy in Action chapter. And for those of you just tuning in or that don't know what we mean by that, each year we include a chapter that has contributions from a collection of groups and individuals who each in their own way strive to shine a critical light on issues and problems that rarely receive the attention they deserve from corporate media outlets. And Steve Masick has been with us on today's program to talk about several of these fantastic individuals and organizations. And Steve Masick, let's move to another one of them. For those not familiar, Propaganda Critic is an amazing online resource. And this inclusion in the chapter this year, Propaganda Critic, a tool for analyzing propaganda in the 21st century, really couldn't be more timely. And the website is propagandacritic.com. Steve, I used this website in my persuasion class last semester at Cal State East Bay, and the students really dove into the site, and it was interesting what a couple of the students said is they said, hey, this website could be almost the whole class. So Steve Masick, tell us about this fantastic resource.
Propaganda Critic is a website that's dedicated to promoting propaganda analysis that has separate entries or pages devoted to each of the more common propaganda techniques, and includes lots and lots of examples of the propaganda techniques that it analyzes in action. It was inspired by the pioneering work of the Institute for Propaganda Analysis, which was founded back in the 1930s. the current website Propaganda Critic has been around for 25 years, and it just recently underwent a kind of complete revamping by a professor of communication at Trinity University in San Antonio, Aaron Delwich. One of its main focuses, though, is on the kind of classic techniques of propaganda that were first identified by the Institute for Propaganda Analysis back in 1937. And those are the following: name-calling, glittering generalities, the transfer technique, testimonials, plain folks appeals, card stacking, and the bandwagon technique. And I would venture to say that you could probably find a speech by Donald Trump that makes use of all seven. The other thing, they've updated the site to include other more recent propaganda techniques that leverage or make use of affordances of online communication. So they point out that recent years, use of bots to spread propaganda through social media, fake user accounts, aka sock puppets. And so they have examples of these sorts of propaganda, uniquely online propaganda techniques as well in the site. And it's a really great resource. If any of your listeners are teachers, whether you're K through 12 or whether you teach college students, if you teach about persuasion or propaganda at all in any kind of class, whether it's a media literacy class, a communications class, journalism class, it's a really invaluable resource.
I have to agree, Steve Masick. You know, on the site, there's a core concepts section. There's an everybody is biased section that talks about implicit bias and so many important things that we need to know about today in our allegedly post-truth world. At Project Censored, we've called attention to this for years because censorship is closely related to propaganda. Talk a little bit about that, Steve, and maybe even an example or two. You know, the media right now is really focused on coronavirus, and rightfully so. But of course, there's other things going on, and there's even propaganda swirling around this, even though this isn't a hoax and this is a real crisis. People don't really know where to get trusted information, and that's in part because we live in a culture that is pervasively manipulated by propaganda.
One way of thinking about censorship is anything that cuts us off to vital, accurate, truthful information that we need as citizens of a democracy. And one way to cut off our access to that information is for the government to simply prevent it from being published. That's the classic censorship as prior restraint. When, for example, the Nixon White House went to the courts to get an injunction to prevent the New York Times from publishing any stories based on Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers that he had leaked to the New York Times, that was a form of censorship as prior restraint. But I think there's an argument to be made that there's another form of censorship, which is where the government doesn't attempt to prevent information, truthful or accurate information, from being reported, but it drowns it out by flooding the media landscape, by flooding the public sphere with misinformation, by drowning it out with noise and with discourse that is full of these sorts of propaganda techniques. So I do think propaganda and censorship is closely related, and I think that you can see that right now what's happening is certain segments of the media are just being flooded with misinformation, with half-truths, with very dubious information that maybe is drowning out important stories about COVID-19 and about the epidemic and why it's happening, but also are drowning out important sorts of other stories. And I mentioned before the wave of wildcat strikes that is taking place around this country that is really getting very little attention, but is, I think, a hugely significant story. I don't know about you. I watch CNN. I read my daily newspaper, which happens to be the Chicago Tribune, every day. I don't see a lot of reporting on it.
We don't, and we're not hearing a lot about U.S. chicanery in Venezuela, pushing regime change again, EPA relaxing enforcement of pollution regulations as if that has anything to do with the current pandemic. And maybe this is a note to end on, not just a gloomy note, but let's spin it back around too. We've been doing a couple shows here the past couple of weeks, Craig Aaron, Victor Picard, colleagues of ours, colleagues of yours, talking about the crisis of local journalism and how we need a major stimulus and multi-billion dollar influx here. You mentioned the Chicago Tribune. Living in an urban area, you've got a paper like that. Cleveland, Ohio, yeah, is losing the Plain Dealer. I mean, this is a huge blow. Earlier in the year, Youngstown lost the Vindicator. There's almost going to be no major newspaper left in the entire state of Ohio.
It's shocking, the closing of the Plain Dealer, which is the daily newspaper for Cleveland, which is not a small metropolitan area. I think that everybody, and I'm sure Victor Picard, when he was on your show, talked about this. Everyone recognizes that the economic downturn that is being precipitated by the COVID-19 crisis is going to really hurt newspapers and news organizations around the country. Hundreds of journalists have been laid off, especially at smaller, more regional papers. But I'm really concerned that Chicago could become one of those major metropolitan areas that loses any kind of daily newspaper. And here's why. Back during the 2008-2009 financial crisis, during that economic downturn, both the Chicago Tribune and the Sun-Times went into bankruptcy, and they emerged out of it as much smaller papers. They had much smaller staffs. The Chicago Sun-Times, I will be very surprised if it survives this crisis, because it was looking as if it might fold already before the economic downturn. It was already looking like, and there was speculation that it might actually fold at some point. Right now, it's owned by a consortium of local investors as well as some labor unions, and I don't know that they have the resources to last even 3 months of a severe recession if the economy is contracting by like 15 or 20%. I think that will be the death knell for the Chicago Sun-Times, which was originally started as a liberal or progressive alternative to the arch-conservative Chicago Tribune. It was actually started by Marshall Field III, the heir to the department store fortune, at the behest of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, basically to provide some sort of liberal alternative to the really extremely reactionary Chicago Tribune. So it would be a real tragedy if we lost that paper, because it is traditionally the more working class paper in Chicago. It's traditionally the more liberal paper in Chicago. I'm almost certain that it's going to fold. But I think the Chicago Tribune, which has gotten to be a much better paper since, say, the 1970s than it once was, is also going to be in real trouble. So we could face a situation where we would have a city of over 3 million with no daily newspaper. That would be a tragedy. As critical as I am of corporate news media, it would be a tragedy because the employees of those two papers do a lot of the spade work and the day-to-day journalism that we all need in a democratic society.
Well, Steve Masick, that's the kind that Catherine Foxhall was saying we needed more of in order to deal with these public information officers. I mean, all through Media Democracy in Action, it comes back to that we need boots on the ground journalists. We need people doing this kind of intrepid work, asking the tough questions. We need people to be media literate. We need people to be able to decode propaganda. We need all of the above of these things. And again, at Project Censored, Andy Lee Roth and I, while we're also, of course, critics of corporate media, we also see the significance and importance of these major news gathering organizations, because between, I think, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you've got might be close to half of people that are working journalists.
Yeah, it's a huge number. And as you say, you need those boots on the ground journalists, because as much as I like citizen journalists and as much as I like independent journalists, they just don't have the resources to be out there covering every PTA meeting, every school board meeting, every city council meeting, scrutinizing every new development plan in particular communities. They simply don't have the resources, the same kind of resources that some of these corporate media have. And I always like to use this example here in the Chicago area in Illinois. The source that broke the story about Rod Blagojevich trying to sell Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat to the highest bidder was the Chicago Sun-Times. They assigned a reporter to the story, they dug into it, and they were unafraid to publish it once they felt that they had an accurate story, because they had lawyers on retainer who would go to court and defend them in case of a libel suit. And as much as I love independent journalists and independent news organizations, oftentimes they don't have the resources to go to bat to fight big lawsuits against really powerful opposition. And so for the time being, at least, we need these corporate news outlets. And some people say, well, what about television news organizations? Aren't they going to pick up the slack? And the fact is they haven't, and they've also been hit with cuts of their own. So broadcast newsrooms, or NPR, they certainly employ more broadcast journalists than corporate television or corporate radio, probably combined, but it's nowhere close to the number of journalists who are employed by daily newspapers, nowhere close to the number of journalists employed by a New York Times, Wall Street Journal, or a Washington Post.
If our listeners have tuned into the show the last couple of weeks, hopefully they've heard Craig Aaron and Victor Picard, and then Steve Masick. You're, of course, illustrating that we need a big, not just a temporary stimulus, like we see the government writing out. We don't just need a stimulus in journalism. And as Picard would argue, we need long-term public investment in a vibrant, a truly vibrant and free press. The organizations that support that are the ones that we write about in the Media Democracy in Action chapter every year. Steve Masick, we've been speaking with you for the hour. You're chair of the Department of Communications and Media Studies at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, outside of Chicago. You compiled that chapter for us this year, Media Democracy in Action, in Censor 2020 Through the Looking Glass. So Steve Masick, thanks so much for all the work that you do and for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
It was a real pleasure, Mickey. It was great to talk to you as always.
Keep up the great work. We'll be talking to you again. You've been listening to the Project Censored show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer and host of the program. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Hawaii to New England. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work through our website, projectcensored.org. And last but certainly not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Stay well. We'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide wars fought for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons filled with capacity citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, if you ain't at the table then you're probably on the menu, we got that love.